missing from the record sleeve where he normally kept them. For years, he had heard nothing of Kai. And then, out of the blue in 1985, as reforms intensified, a letter had gotten through. Only then did he learn that Kai had left the country. In 1978, after visiting Sparrow in Coldwater Ditch, he had crossed the border into Hong Kong, where he applied for asylum. Within a year, he had married, left for Canada, and had a daughter. The first letters had trickled into Coldwater Ditch, arriving every 6 months. Now, in Beijing, the letters from Canada came every few weeks. Kai said he no longer played the piano. This turning away from music was impossible to explain. He was haunted by people and events. He felt he had been sleeping all these years. He wanted desperately to return to China, however briefly, but his defection made it impossible. The government refused to grant him a visa. Could Sparrow come and see him in Hong Kong? He had already looked into all the particulars. Kai would wire money that might serve as a guarantee for Sparrow's exit visa. This detail was entered into the letter as if it were an ordinary passing thought. Sparrow did not comprehend, but the texture of Kai's writing, the inability to picture either of them in a foreign country, the inability, in truth, to picture the outside world at all, embarrassed him. Sparrow wrote a hesitant reply. And then, last month, Kai had written to him, "Long ago you told me not to turn back, but I know now that you were mistaken. I knew it then, Sparrow, but I was too afraid to see it. I was too selfish. And what right did I have to ask you for anything? But, Sparrow, the future depends on knowing what we loved and who we have become. Please, if you can, please come to Hong Kong. There are too many things between us. There is a lifetime. I recently learned that the professor was imprisoned and survived the turmoil. He passed away in 1981. We never reconciled. How could I not know of his death until now?" Even when he tried to remember, it came to him like another life. Love was his devotion to his parents, to Ling, to Ai Ming, to this life. But if this was love, what was the other? "Ba, what's wrong?" Where were the letters? He had looked at them only a few weeks ago and had left them hidden in the sleeve of a Glenn Gould album. "What are you doing on the floor?" Ai Ming said.
"I'm looking for the record," he said.
"What record?" In the evenings, before the lamps were lit, a person could mistake her for Zhu Li. The same querying eyes, the same persistent observation. "Leave me," he thought. "One day, won't Zhu Li leave me?" But the thought shamed him. "Is it your hands? They're giving you pain again, aren't they? Come and sit on the sofa." Kai had a daughter, too. How did a person know, he wondered? What was love, and what was a facsimile of it? Did it matter? Was the thing that mattered most the action that one took, or failed to take, in the name of that feeling? "Tell me what record it is, Ba." Those radios outside kept up their warnings. "This is a planned conspiracy and chaos. Its essence is to negate the leadership of the party and the socialist system once and for all." Ai Ming was kneeling on the floor beside him. His daughter chose a record. She chose Scarlatti's Sonatas in D. Sparrow had a sickly desire to crawl into the machine. In 1977, he remembered hearing that, during the Democracy Wall protests, a man his age, named Huang Xiang,
had pasted up a poem he had written during the Cultural Revolution. Throughout the 1970s, as he wrote the poem, he had covered each page in plastic, wrapped it around a candle, then added another layer of wax around it. When the Cultural Revolution ended, he melted the candles and removed all 94 pages of his poem. Was this a real story? Sparrow had wondered. Or was it something like the Book of Records, an imagined survival? How was it possible that people of his generation had taken part in such acts, and yet these acts remained so desperately hidden? What happened if you melted a person down layer by layer? What if there was nothing between the layers and nothing at the center? Only quiet. Grief for Comrade Hu Yaobang is being used to confuse and poison people's minds. Yes, he thought, this is what grief does. It is a confusion, perhaps a poison, that breaks us apart until finally we become something new. Or had he been lying to himself? What if he had failed to create someone new? Father. She put a glass in his hand, and he tasted baijiu. How sweet the alcohol was on his tongue. A few quick sips, and it might numb his body, thereby releasing him, as in the old saying, when wine sinks, words swim. Aiming, he said, no matter what happens, you must write these examinations. You must do well. University was the only way, he thought, to force open the door. Ba, she said, it's not too late for you to go abroad. Don't you still need to write your music? Why did everyone keep mentioning his music? Couldn't they just let it go? He drank the liquid down, pretending he had not heard her properly. Before the watchful eyes of Aiming, he felt exposed, as if the weakness of the times had lodged inside him, slowly pulverizing all that was unique and his alone, because he had allowed it to do so. To his great relief, Aiming stood up and left him. He sat in front of the record player. The composer inside him had fallen silent, because Sparrow had allowed him to do so. All revolutionary intellectuals, now is the time to go into battle. Let us unite, holding high the great red banner of Mao Zedong thought. Unite around the party's central committee. But no, those words, that editorial, had come from a different era, a different movement. It was only a memory. Hidden in the record sleeve of Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, conducted by Leopold Stokowski, with Glenn Gould as soloist, along with the letters from Kai, was a photo of the three of them together, Sparrow, Zhu Li, and Kai. His cousin was in the middle, 14 years old, the only one who looked straight into the camera, the only one with nothing to hide. She had been learning Prokofiev. It had been around the time of Spring Festival, and he remembered how much she had fallen for that composer.
Sparrow, do you think it's possible to love something too much?
She had grasped his hand the way a child does. She had still been a child in that summer of 1966.
But each phrase is so full. If I tried to hear all its overtones and undertones, nothing would ever get played.
Yet she had learned to hear a great deal, he thought. She had heard too many voices and given credit to them all. They had been taught, through the lessons of Chairman Mao and the ecstasy of revolution, that death could preserve a truth. But death preserved nothing, he thought. It removed the wholeness of those left behind, and the truth they once knew vanished, unrecorded, unreal,
like sound dissipating. He had lived only half a life. Without intending to, he had silenced Du Li. He remembered how much of himself he had poured into that symphony number 3. He could have left the papers in the trusses of the roof. He could have hidden them with a book of records. Why had he not done so? Why had he destroyed them with his own hands? A line from Big Mother's most recent letter from Coldwater Ditch came back to him. There is no way across the river but to feel for the stones. Chapter 4 Yiwen had told Aiming that students from every Beijing university would be demonstrating the following day, in defiance of the April 26th editorial.
"I'm going,"
Yiwen had said. She had been in the middle of braiding Aiming's hair, and unconsciously gave the braid an angry tug.
"I don't care what my parents say. We went to a funeral, and the government called us criminals. Do they expect us to just shut our mouths? We're not the same as they are."
In her study, Aiming closed her eyes. She missed the companionship of Big Mother's snoring hulk. In her memory, she was back in Coldwater Ditch. She was the same nosy child, snooping into Big Mother's book trunk. Here were the 42 notebooks of the Book of Records, a girl's blue dress, as well as a pamphlet with a yellow cover, and on the cover the words, "Gods and Emperors." The pages had fascinated her. Later she understood it was a political tract, and an answer to Deng Xiaoping's celebrated 4 modernizations. "We want no more gods and emperors," the writer had proclaimed. "No more saviors of any kind. We want to be masters of our own country. Democracy, freedom, and happiness are the only goals of modernization. Without this 5th modernization, the other 4 are nothing more than a new-fangled lie." When she opened her eyes, she looked out and saw Yiwen's mother sitting in the courtyard, washing clothes. The pink dress rose briefly from the water before it was pushed under again, reemerging tangled up in the arms of a shirt. As soon as her parents left for work, Aiming shut her books. She went outside, walked calmly to the north gate of the alleyway, and retrieved her bicycle. She hopped on. As she pedaled away from the books, she felt suddenly free, airborne. At the Chinese Academy of Sciences, she swerved across the intersection, dodged a cart loaded with water drums, and continued on under the big trees of Yuyuantan Park. Side streets and delivery lanes opened up before her, and she flew north until she reached the 3rd Ring Road. Here, noise pummeled the buildings. At first, all she could see were hundreds of green-hatted police. But behind them, just visible on the other side, were the edges of innumerable banners, mostly red and gold, like a wedding. The loudspeakers, out of sync, blurted out garbled warnings. "Demonstrations without official approval are illegal and will be banned. Demonstrations without official approval." On Aiming's side of the police lines, 2 old men in white vests were holding a neatly written banner. "The way ahead is long and far, yet I will search far and wide." But the 2, who reminded her of Fa Lut, already seemed tottery on their skinny grandfather legs. Aiming locked her bicycle to a grate and squeezed onto the overpass. Looking down, she saw the students pressed right up against the police line, where the officers had hitched themselves together arm in arm. The students were using the sheer mass of their numbers to slowly, tectonically, exert pressure. It was fierce and sweaty work. I was a silly egg to think I would be able to find Yiwen, she told herself, blushing at the unexpected thought. The mass of young people disappeared into the horizon, as if the crowd stretched all the way to Beijing University itself. A boy who had climbed up a lamppost called out that comrades from the University of Politics and Law had banded together and broken through a blockade at the Second Ring Road. Noise rioted up, vibrating the overpass. She watched as ladies coming to or from work in factory blues, pink aprons, and green smocks tried to sweet-talk the officers into letting the students through. Old people sat on their balconies as if watching opera, shouting at everyone to get on with it. Even as it grew increasingly tense, it was clear to Ai Ming that the police had no intention of pulling out their weapons. They were simply placing their bodies in the way. Minutes passed, another half hour, and still the agonizing pushing went on. The students, all neatly dressed, attractive with their earnest glasses, began chanting the words of Comrade Deng himself. A revolutionary government should listen to the voice of the people. Nothing should frighten it more than silence. On this side, the residents joined in, so that the police were pinioned between two tidal waves of sound. This went on for half an hour before everyone stopped to rest. Meanwhile, up on the overpass, it was shoulder against shoulder, chest against back, with still more people arriving. Ai Ming was so sweaty, she feared she might be squeezed like a slippery fish off the bridge. The students were reorganizing. All the young women had been sent up to the head of the line. A few men around Ai Ming laughed dirtily. A soothing female chorus rose up. "Raise the incomes of the police!" "Brothers," a young woman called, "you have been working hard all morning. Citizens of Beijing, bring water to the people's police." Amidst laughter and cheering, water materialized. Ai Ming scanned continuously for Yiwen. A few police lifted off their peaked caps, withdrew colorful handkerchiefs, and mopped the sweat from their faces. They smiled shyly at the girls, who giggled. Everyone exhaled like a rest between sets. The students managed to reformulate themselves so that boys and girls were mixed together once more. Meanwhile, the overpass took up the chant, "What's so hard? It's like cutting cabbages and melons." By now, Ai Ming had been on the overpass for almost 3 hours, and she too felt the moment had arrived. She couldn't stand to be further compressed. From the boulevard of protesters, more cries came, rolling forward with piercing intensity. "Reject the verdict of the People's Daily. We are not a mob. We are civilized members of society." Under this sustained pressure, Ai Ming could see the sweating police beginning to fray. The students pressed their advantage, all the while chanting, "The people love the people's police." The students heaved through the center, and the green police lines dissolved to the sides, like a soft leaf curling open. Ai Ming heard an uprush of sound that felt as if it were coming from the concrete and the buildings themselves. Residents leaned so far out, she was afraid they would all tumble off the flyover together. Her own shouts of both astonishment and relief were lost in the tumult. Even though the success of the students seemed inevitable, it also seemed impossible, and everyone looked mildly stunned. A police hat flew nonsensically up onto the overpass, and Ai Ming, finding it in her hands, gently tossed it down to a bareheaded officer.
who gazed up into the sun, looking for her. She waved. Carts of water and icy tea appeared. Beside her, a toothless old man was throwing popsicles down to the crowd. A huddle of police were talking into radios, a few were grinning, and students patted their shoulders as they went by. A banner passed. A new path is opening up, the path we long ago failed to take. The marchers moved forward, surrounded on all sides by student marshals with red armbands. Ai Ming ran to unlock her bicycle from the grate. Pushing it beside her, she slipped between the lines of students. Everyone's clothes were rumpled, as if they'd all been wrestling or turning over and over in their sleep. They weren't asking for anything impossible, Ai Ming thought. Just room to move, to grow up and be free, and for the party to criticize itself. A red banner from Beijing University read in proud golden characters, "Without the Communist Party, there would be no new China." The closer they came to the square, the more the crowd seemed to become a part of her own body, so that Ai Ming herself expanded limitlessly as students from other universities continued to arrive, connecting at intersections between the first and second ring roads. Cooks in tired hats and white aprons stood outside their kitchens. Waiters smoked passionately. Shop girls teetered out of department stores so that around 6 in the afternoon, when office and factory workers came off their shifts, they were all crushed together in the smaller roads. People, her parents' age, kept pressing water, ice cream sandwiches, frozen fruit, and inch of gold candies into her hands. Sugar-struck, Ai Ming thought she saw the dazzling pink of Yiwen's headband. She followed it, as if following torchlight. "Yiwen!" she shouted. Her lungs were bursting. "Yiwen!" Without her realizing that it was happening, what she appeared to be on the outside and who she was on the inside had become the same. Rapture felt so strangely light. A knot of journalists from the People's Daily passed by holding hands. They didn't bother to hide their badges. One carried a signboard that read, "Free Thoughts, Free Speech." The air was inundated with words like this, banners and posters that covered the street like movable type, as if the sidewalk itself was an enormous banned book. It was difficult to believe that what she witnessed was real and not a counter-revolutionary's hallucination. And, stranger still, there was no weeping, no regret or anxiety about the past, and none of the day-to-day insincerity which was a normal part of everyday life. And here was Yiwen, just ahead of her. Ai Ming halved the distance between them and halved it again. The police had evaporated as if they too belonged to some other Beijing. And had someone pulled out the wires of the loudspeakers? Ai Ming ran up to her friend. The uneven pavement made the bicycle bell jingle, and hearing it, Yiwen turned, saw her, and broke into a luminous smile. "What is revolution?" Yiwen said, half laughing, half crying. "Ai Ming, what is revolution?" Could it also look like this? Ai Ming wondered. Yiwen reached around, hugging her waist. "This is revolution," she said, her mouth brushing Ai Ming's hair. Because of her father's low political status in Cold Water Ditch, she had never had a true friend before. They were walking like family who had lost and then found one another. Tiananmen was a gate, the passageway to a square with no walls, no obstacles, just the wind and space to breathe,
and even a call to abandon oneself. Couples embraced. They clung to one another in wide-eyed desire. Maybe, she thought, by the time the examinations arrived, the content of her thoughts would be permissible. The only thing that would need measuring would be the quality of her argument. If so, this change had occurred suddenly. With so little forewarning, and before she had even thought to ask for it, or dared to imagine that overnight a society could change. Ewan was singing. Now your hands are shaking, now your tears are falling. Maybe what you're saying is, you love me, with nothing to my name, come with me, come with me. She wanted Ewan's arm never to lift from her waist. Maybe if China could get better, she would no longer desire to escape abroad. Celebration rattled the streets. Ling's bus entered the Third Ring Road before coming to a standstill in the face of bicycles and crowds. She stepped down as if into a different city. Even here, several kilometers away from Tiananmen Square, she could hear the chanting. There were explanations on people's lips, but none that made sense. The student demonstrations broke through 3,000 police. The square is blocked off, so they've filled Chang'an Avenue. All they did was present a petition, and our government called them counter-revolutionaries. Shame! Enjoy it while it lasts. No flower can live 100 days. Red bits of banners clung to trees, just as only 2 weeks ago, funeral chrysanthemums had blanketed the boulevards. At home, Ling pushed her shoes off, went to the dining table, and hung her purse on the chair. The apartment was quiet. She knocked at Aiming's door, and receiving no answer, opened it. Sparrow was writing. When he looked up, it was as if he had no idea where he was. Ling took a breath. The room smelled of alcohol. Has Aiming gone to the square? She was already gone by the time I came home. His hand covered the sheet of paper before him. Outside, the street noise grew, dissolved, and came again, like an explosion. Every citizen is on the street tonight, it seems, except you, dear Sparrow. She came nearer, looking closely at her husband's face. He was extremely pale.
"What's happened?"
she asked. "Are you worried about the demonstrators? The government won't arrest the whole city. They can't." He couldn't look at her. "What are the students asking for?" "I'm not sure they know anymore. The government accused them of inciting chaos. They compare them to the Red Guards, and the students don't agree. Nobody does." Sparrow stood up. "They have no idea of the risk," he said. He moved towards the door, as if this room was too crowded. Ling followed him out. The sheet of paper turned over, remained where it was.
"But what if,"
she said, following him into the kitchen. Suddenly exhausted, Ling sat down at the table.
"Those students are rebelling against us, too. Against our generation, I mean."
Sparrow said nothing. When had they last had an honest conversation, she wondered. Could it be months or even years since they last confided in one another?
"We let the party decide our jobs, our fates, our homes, and the education of our children. We submitted because
we thought some good might come."
"But when did we stop believing it? Look at me. I edit transcripts, and I'm grateful for the job. My life is a mountain of paperwork and a sea of meetings."
She laughed, but found her own laugh alarming.
"Unlike us, these young people have literally no memory. Without memory, they're free.
Yes, he said.
I've been thinking about my life, Sparrow. Not the past, but the future. Don't you ever think about yours?
Yes, of course. But here in Beijing, sometimes I imagine that I... But we...
Aiming burst into the apartment, elated. Ling caught a glimpse of another girl darting down the alleyway, a flash of neon color. It was the neighbor's wild daughter, Yiwen.
Sparrow turned towards the door. Where have you been?
At the square, of course. Ah, you should see it. All the people.
He began to berate her. Aiming stared at her father as if he were a stranger.
How can I protect you? He yelled. How?
He had drunk more than Ling had supposed. She stood up from the table and went towards him. Sparrow kept on.
The government is right. You're no different from the Red Guards. You think you know everything? You think you can judge everyone? You think you're the only ones who love this country? You think you can overturn everything in a day, a moment?
Sparrow, Ling said.
They stole everything,
Sparrow said, turning to her.
But why did we let them do it? Why did we give in? I remember everything now. My brothers, I couldn't... Du Li, they needed me to help them, but I didn't. Why did we throw away everything that mattered to us?
Ling's heart was breaking. She had never seen him come apart. She had stopped thinking that he could. It was as if someone had cut a single wire inside him on which everything had depended.
Sparrow, let it go.
How?
Aiming, Ling said, wanting to shield their daughter. Go to your room.
Aiming obeyed. Tears streamed down her face.
How can I forget?
Sparrow's face was drained of color. He looked at Ling as if she had always known the answer.
If I forget, what's left? There's nothing.
All she wanted was to lie down, close her eyes and rest. But she had to get out of this room, out of the falseness of this home. Ling picked up her purse from the chair. The walls were pressing in on her, and she couldn't breathe, thinking of everything she had given up for her family, but most of all, for the party. She looked once more at her husband, who had covered his face with his hands.
Don't you see? She said. Things are changing.
He didn't answer.
Live your life, Sparrow. It's the best thing either of us can do for our daughter.
She went out the door, through the alleyway, and into the street.
When Sparrow woke, the room, the city, was quiet. He got out of bed, lit the lamp, and took the letter out of its hiding place. On the kitchen table, the paper gleamed whitely. Even if I had the means to leave, I was content in my life. The night sky was a thickening dark. He would like to have a piano. He would like to sit right now in the darkness of a practice room. Music for him had always been a way of thinking. He pushed the pages away. Sparrow could not imagine leaving his daughter behind. Aiming was so much like Du Li. Were they similar because of him? Had he failed to give his daughter the room she needed? In the 18 years of Aiming's life, he had never been separated from her, not for a day. He covered the letter with his hands and chided himself for being mournful. If he could sweep away all this mournfulness, which must only be a kind of dust from his previous lives, he would be a better father and a kinder husband. Ling's confidence and goodness had always sustained him. He had no right to grieve.
Their neighbor was listening to the radio. Sparrow could hear the anchor's even drone, but not the words. Music began echoing through the alleyway. But it was music he couldn't recognize. Music from an era he didn't know. Music composed in the present. Ongoing disruptions in the street, in the factory, and in his home continued. He suspected Aiming was going to the square every day, but neither he nor Ling had the will or influence to stop her. On the May 1st holiday, he telephoned Cold Water Ditch on the neighborhood phone. Big Mother came onto the line and shouted,
"Workers' Day? We live in a communist country. Every day is Workers' Day."
He could hear Ba Lut giggling behind her. Big Mother grumbled,
"Tell that lazy Aiming to study hard."
When he said there was unrest in Beijing, she said,
"Good. Nobody should be at rest."
How, he wondered, when he put down the phone, had Big Mother managed to raise a son like him? It was impossible not to believe in the mischief of the gods. The May 4th demonstrations came and went, as large as the preceding April 27th demonstration, and included a contingent from Sparrow's own Beijing Wire Factory No. 3. But he did not go. Sleep became impossible. Sparrow took to walking at night. Even at 2 or 3 in the morning, bicycles roamed the streets, students flitting from one place to another. Time felt elastic, stretching into unfamiliar shapes, so that he could be both in Beijing and in Shanghai, an old man and a young man, in the world and in his thoughts. One night, he came across 3 men and 2 women playing music at the closed gates of Jade Pond Park. The musicians made time disappear. On Chinese instruments, they played the dignified promenade from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. Mussorgsky's 10 movements depicted an imaginary tour of an art collection, and the composition had been written in honor of his friend, a painter who had died suddenly at the age of 39. A deep and unfamiliar calm pervaded Sparrow. On a nearby pillar, someone had pasted up a letter. "I've been searching for myself, but I didn't expect to find so many selves of mine." When morning came, the musicians packed up their instruments. Sparrow bought a dough stick and savored it as he watched the night workers go off duty and the day workers go on. One evening, he arrived home from the factory to find a gift from Aiming. She had bought one of the new Japanese cassette players, small enough to fit into one hand. His daughter was so delighted with the gadget, she could not restrain herself from testing all the buttons and trying the headphones herself, adjusting and readjusting the volume. They might have toyed with it all night, had Ling not dragged them out for supper. He continued his nighttime walks, listening to the Walkman. Aiming had made 12 tapes for him, copying them, she said, from someone called Fat Lips. Lately, she had friends all over the place. One evening, Sparrow walked all the way to the university district, listening to Bach's Goldberg Variations. In the darkness, one could always hear better. The music became as real as the concrete sidewalks and stout brick walls. Elderly guards at the entrance to Beijing University were immersed in their midnight card game, and so Sparrow passed through the gate unimpeded. Perhaps in his innocuous clothes, he had been mistaken for a cleaner or a parent visiting from the countryside. Low lights flickered in the student dormitories, where, now and again, excited figures were visible in the narrow windows. The tape ended, and he hit the eject button, removed the cassette, and turned it over. The machine made satisfying clicks. Cannonades of laughter came from the dormitories, arriving in staggered bursts. Posters clung to every surface. Banners wept from the windows. The ground was a deluge of papers and empty bottles. Workers were sweeping up the debris, twig brooms scratching the cement. The variations started up again. The cassette was Glenn Gould, Iming had told him, but a different 1981 recording of the Goldberg variations. In the opening aria, each note seemed to Sparrow as if it had been pulled open rather than pressed down. Occasionally, he heard Glenn Gould himself humming. Why had Gould gone back to record the same piece of music again? No one could tell him. Fat Lips only had this one edition, Iming had said, a copy of a copy that a foreigner had given him. The counterpoint folded over in his mind. The further Sparrow walked into Beijing University, the greater the quantity of political posters. Even the trees had not been spared. Torches had been set up, and here and there boys wandered by in shorts, reading the posters. Just as people of Sparrow's generation, at the post office and elsewhere, study the newspapers displayed in their plastic boxes, more posters were being pasted up over the old ones, making an ever-thickening book of protest. In 1966, Beijing Red Guards had written, "We must tell you, a spider cannot stop the wheel of a cart. We will carry socialist revolution through to the end." 23 years later, Beijing students wrote, "Democracy takes time to achieve. It cannot be accomplished overnight." But several proposed an immediate hunger strike that would occupy Tiananmen Square before the arrival of Mikhail Gorbachev in 4 days' time. A tall boy gestured menacingly at him, but Glenn Gould prevented Sparrow from hearing the shouted words. Sparrow pushed his headphones off.
"I said, don't think of tearing anything down," the student said impatiently. "I know you're a fucking government spy."
Sparrow was so surprised, he mumbled an apology. He backed away, nearly tripping over a gracefully written pennant with the words, "A society that speaks with only one voice is not a stable society." The breeze cooled him. He left the grassy hill and exited through the gates of Beida to the tree-lined edge of Haidian Park. In this unfamiliar city, Glenn Gould seemed his only confidant, the most familiar presence. "Do I really look like a spy?" Sparrow wondered. "Are there spies who behave like me?" 100 radios passed through Sparrow's hands. In the evenings, when he went to Tiananmen Square, the boulevards had a serene yet haunting openness. The wide streets themselves seemed to promise an end to this impasse. The government had not reversed its condemnation of the student protest, but had begun to speak in soothing tones. General Secretary Zhao Ziyang, who had worked closely with the deceased Hu Yaobang, had used a May 4th speech to air his own point of view. The students, he said, were calling on the Communist Party to correct its mistakes and improve its work style, and these criticisms were in line with the party's own assessment of itself. "We should meet the students' reasonable demands through democracy and law. We should be willing to reform, and we should use rational and orderly methods." To Sparrow's great surprise, the press had begun reporting on student demonstrations that were occurring not only in Beijing, but outside the capital, in some 51 cities. A fracture had appeared in the system, and now water was rushing in to widen it. Ling said that even within her work unit at State Radio, the consensus was that the government had been too harsh. The demonstrations offered an opportunity. If the party could prove its sincerity, it would win the loyalty of a further generation. The nights continued. growing ever warmer. He wrote to Kai to say, "Yes, I will come." And having sent the letter off, lost himself by walking the Musidi alleyways. Listening to another of Aiming's tapes, this one, Shostakovich's Fourth Symphony, which had gone unperformed for 25 years. What would it be like to go to Canada at this stage in his life? What if Kai could sponsor Aiming? He would pay the money back. But what about Ling and this life? What about his parents? In what way was he still a composer, if he had made not a sound for more than 20 years? There were no answers to his questions. Yet the knowledge that he would see Kai brought him an undeniable, undiluted pleasure. Upon sending the letter, Sparrow had felt abruptly changed, that a few simple words could transform him. "Yes, I will come," unsettled him. But why should he continue to fear? Wasn't society changing? Nearly a month had passed since Hu Yaobang's death, a month in which Beijing students continued to boycott classes. There were rumors that high-ranking members of the Communist Party were prepared to sit down with the students face-to-face and take part in a televised dialogue. If so, this would be the first time such an event had occurred in Sparrow's lifetime. He could not fathom it, and remembered still He Luting, his head forced down by Red Guards. A change in the system of government had the power to change the fundamental construction of the world he knew. He would go to Hong Kong. A truthful end could come at last. He and Kai were no longer young. They had families of their own. It was difficult to move on without an end. But move on to what? He could not think so far into the future, and if he thought of Ling, all his childish imaginings evaporated. Everything changed in a day, an hour, a moment. In the past, he had misread events. He had reacted too slowly. Sparrow had made mistakes, but he promised himself he would not make them again. Now, in the afternoons, when he came home from work, Sparrow sat down at Aiming's desk and composed. The old Symphony No. 3 was gone. He could no longer retrieve what it might have been, and so he had started a new work, a simpler piece, a sonata for piano and violin. The Japanese composer Toru Takemitsu once described his own work as a picture scroll unrolled, and Sparrow felt a kinship with this image. He could hear this sonata in his head as surely as he could hear Bach and Shostakovich on the cassette player. The sonata was real and had already been created. One's own mind, the saying went, concealed more information than 5 cartloads of books. It was like learning to breathe again, not just with his lungs, but with his whole mind. On May 13th, the students went on hunger strike. Sparrow was working in Aiming's room when the announcement was broadcast on the radio. He sensed that the piano and violin piece was unfolding at a sped-up tempo, and he erased the last hour's work and began again. Recounting the measures, altering the space between development and return, 2 themes supporting one another. The line of the piano was difficult to hold, but the violin felt supple and unceasing. It was not heroic. It wished only to play for itself alone, even if it knew such a thing was not truly possible. A commentator on the radio argued that these revolutionary youth were part of a deliberate attempt to humiliate the government and the nation. Why else begin a hunger strike 2 days before our historic summit with Mikhail Gorbachev? This is the first visit from a Soviet leader in 40 years. Another said the students' intentions were good, but their methods were immature, and it was imperative that they refrain from damaging the nation's image. The news also seemed to be wrestling with its own head. The newsreader announced that General Secretary Zhao Ziyang favored far-reaching press reforms so that content and analysis would be decided by news editors and not party officials. A sharp pain in Sparrow's back flared unexpectedly, and he felt like an old piano that couldn't be tuned. At work the following day, the factory was unproductive. Half his co-workers had signed on to the new Independent Workers Union, operating from under a tarp on Chang'an Avenue. They had gone so far as to identify themselves by their real names, even showing their work badges. His co-workers only wanted news of the square. Sparrow hadn't yet signed on. He was trying to imagine himself boarding the plane for Hong Kong. Kai had been true to his word, and Sparrow's exit visa had been approved. For the first time in his life, he would travel outside China. Kai had begun to float other ideas. "We could teach at the Hong Kong Conservatory. I have also made inquiries at the Vancouver Conservatory of Music. What have you been composing? Send me what you have." He began to suspect that Kai was living an illusion more complex than his own. Fan, who worked the line with him, tapped her pencil on his desk.
"Comrade Sparrow," she said, "you look hideous. Do you have a fever? Is it contagious? Maybe you should get home and rest."
Fan was still so young, Sparrow thought suddenly. If Zhu Li were alive, she would be 37 years old. These days, she entered his thoughts freely, as if some barrier between them had broken down.
"I'm not..." "Go on! Production is non-existent, anyway."
Fan got up. He could see her in the next aisle talking to the floor supervisor, known to everyone as Baby Corn. Sparrow didn't know why. His hands were trembling. Perhaps he did have a fever. Baby Corn came over, deferential, as if Sparrow were his ancestor.
"Comrade Sparrow, you're looking dead on your feet. Take the afternoon off. You're back on shift tomorrow anyway, aren't you?"
"I would prefer to stay."
Sparrow was afraid he would be criticized later on for not working to his full capacity. They would use this weakness to reprioritize him and lay him off. If he lost his job, they might revoke Ai Ming's Beijing papers, and she would not be allowed to sit the university examinations.
"I insist,"
Baby Corn said, distracted. He wandered a few steps away and gazed into the large face of his brand new watch.
"Come on," Fan whispered. "He's a real pain when he's angry. Besides, you look awful. Did you injure your back? At your age, you've got to take better care of yourself."
As he left, he heard the newsreader saying that talks between the government and the students, scheduled for the morning, had been canceled. Outside, even the breeze felt sticky. He had started cycling to and from work because the buses were not reliable. Ling had told him that youth from across the country were pouring into Beijing by the tens of thousands. They were painting democracy slogans on train cars so that wherever the trains went, the student messages too would go. Sparrow pedaled slowly across the factory grounds, ashamed of his exhaustion. If he was not careful, they would all be calling him grandfather, which was ludicrous because he was not even 50. He ended up on Chang'an Avenue, his bicycle inching through traffic as if he were part of a larger procession. He hadn't meant to go to Tiananmen Square. It was only that he neglected to turn right after the Muxidi Bridge and had continued straight. Chang'an Avenue was jammed. Now he couldn't turn around even if he wanted to. He had grown up in Shanghai,
the most modern of Chinese cities, and yet he felt like an outsider here, out of his depth. The flood of Beijingers carried him forward until, glimpsing the square, he saw that it was once more overrun with banners representing more universities than he could count. And now Sparrow truly did not wish to be here. Loudspeakers were broadcasting continuously. A young woman's frail voice crackled over the street. "The country is our country. The people are our people. The government is our government. Who will shout if not us? Who will act if not us?" Sparrow got down from his bicycle and began to push it. The young woman was using the exact words of Chairman Mao, written when Mao Zedong was a young fighter. Beside Sparrow, an enormous man with a grizzled face was reading the newspaper as he walked.
"This hunger strike," Sparrow said to him, "is it real? Will the students really refuse food?"
"Aye, these kids."
The stranger's badge, stamped with the words capital iron and seal, trembled from a clip on his shirt.
"It'll be over in a few hours. Old Gorbachev will be escorted into the square tomorrow, and the party will shake the kids off Tiananmen like ants from a stick."
He folded the paper in half.
"That's what my son tells me, anyway."
"And all these people?"
"Exactly. I came to see what's gotten everyone so worked up. Of course I admire their ideals, who doesn't? But even a nothing like me can see that the students and the government aren't speaking the same language. Everyone wants to fix the country. But everyone wants power, too, don't they? That's what we're talking about in my Tan Wei."
He tapped his badge.
"Our work unit alone has over 200,000 workers. And if we support the hunger strike, that changes everything, doesn't it? That's a bloody revolution."
He took a bag of buns, as if by magic, from his other hand, and offered one to Sparrow, who accepted. The man ate half of one in a single bite.
"Any kids, comrade?"
"A daughter."
"Not a university student, I hope?"
"Thank heavens, no."
The man swallowed the bread in his mouth and washed it down with a gulp from his tea thermos.
"Frankly, I don't understand what's wrong with us. The stupidity we went through. A whole generation slapping its own head. How come we keep arriving at the same point?"
He screwed the lid back on his thermos.
"Hey, you're not a plain coat, are you? Someone told me there are thousands of plain coats snooping around."
"A spy?"
Sparrow smiled. "No, but other people have thought the same."
"Because you're so unthreatening," the man said. "Don't take offense. It's just that you've got such a listening face."
It was twilight. Behind the monument of the people's heroes, hundreds of students were lying on the ground. They were guarded by other students, wearing red armbands, who made a kind of human barricade around them. Sparrow felt that a world he had been living inside was being forced open. But weren't these students also living inside a world of their own construction? The hunger strikers had the brightest futures in the entire country. As Beijing University graduates, they would be responsible for their parents and grandparents, for their siblings if they had any. Yet here they were, lying on the bare concrete. He felt a gnawing fear scraping against his lungs. Three boys on one bicycle rolled by, acrobatic, joyful. They shouted,
"We won't eat fried democracy!"
And a ripple of laughter came from the pajama-clad students. Where were their parents, he wondered. But now a boy, with a red armband, came to him and said sternly,
"Don't take this the wrong way, comrade, but only we are allowed here. It's for the security of our hunger strike revolutionaries."
Sparrow nodded, backing away.
The recording on the loudspeaker began again. It was the same fragile voice as before. Today, freedom and democracy must be bought with